Session number 7257, Clifford Lane, Part 1.
Before I ask you about your war experiences, could you tell me a little bit about your early life? Whereabouts were you born, Mr. Lee?
At Enfield Lock. I was born in 1894, December 1894. And I went to Chesterfield Road Elementary School, I stayed there till I was 14, and that was really the only formal education that I had. But I did go to Clark's College for several months, as my father wanted me to get into the civil service. My father was a builder, but only a working builder. In other words, he had been a carpenter. And he joined up with a bricklayer and started a building business in Enfield Lock, somewhere about 1896, I should think. And the business prospered for several years, because at that time, or just after that time, the South African War started, you see, and the demand for rifles, of course, was very great. They built quite a number of working-class houses, and this went on till about 1910. And then the whole building industry collapsed, more or less. In other words, it's a kind of recession, I suppose. And the partnership was dissolved, and each partner carried on a small jobbing business on his own, you see. Well, as I say, I went to Clark's College and I passed the Boy Clerk's exam in 1910, I should think. It's 10, yeah, that's about right. And I was given a situation in the stores department of the post office at Stud Street, Islington. My duty was to prepare tickets for postmen's uniforms, and we had to do an average of 80, I think it was 80 tickets an hour. Anyway, that job went on till I was about nearly 18. At that time, a boy clerk was only a temporary position. And if you didn't pass another exam before you were 18, you got the sack. And I passed what is called the assistant clerk's examination. And that was limited to people already in the civil service. The boy clerk's exam itself was open to anybody, you see, but this was limited to people already having a position in the civil service. I was then transferred to the secretary's office of the post office in St. Martin's le Grand. And I stayed there till the 1914 war started. I'd already enlisted in 1913 in the 1st Hertfordshire Regiment as a territorial army. And we were mobilised on August the 4th while we were at camp at Shorncliffe.
Was it usual for young men to join the territorials in those days?
Well, no, they were usually under strength. The territorial army was usually under strength, but it was an extraordinary situation because I wanted to join the Civil Service Rifles, you see. And I went to their headquarters in Somerset House, but they weren't taking any recruits. And so I made up my mind to join something, so Hertfordshire was my next county, you see, and the headquarters were only about a couple of miles from where I lived, and I was accepted and became a private in the 1st Hertfordshire Regiment.
Can you remember the events leading up to the war? Were you expecting a war?
Well, now, that's the point. There's no doubt that there was quite a lot of comment on the possibility of a war with Germany. There's no doubt about that. But it was mostly in a sort of a humorous way. You know, nobody seemed to take it seriously. And a few of us who knew something about, had read something about the Germans and the German army, could see it as something more, much more serious than the mass of the people. And the fact is, of course, that the German army had already conquered France quite almost easily in 1870. And moreover, our showing in the South African war hadn't given us much confidence because we had took 3 or 4 years to beat the Boers. Anyway, yes, it certainly was, and there was a lot of sniping at Germany in papers like the Daily Mail. You know, it was a sort of nationalism, really. But of course, you've got to realise that the patriotic spirit in those days was so firm that no Englishman ever thought that the England could be beaten in any war, you see. And although our army was so pitifully small compared with the German army, it was nevertheless thought that on the basis of one volunteer is worth three press men, that we would be victorious in any event, you see. And any suggestion that we might be beaten by Germany was ruled out. Of course, the Navy was our prime defence force, and of course the Navy was regarded as absolutely super, and really we relied on that idea that gave us a sense of security, you see.
So when the war broke out, did you think it would last 4 years?
When the war broke out, I remember the state of euphoria there was. People getting quite excited as if we were going on a sort of a holiday, really, you know. And everybody again thought that it wouldn't last very long. You see, we realised that it was not only us, it was France and Russia, you see. And what they did, they counted up the number of men, you see. Well, of course, the Russians have got millions, you see. The French had got millions too. And nobody seemed to give consideration to the fact that it wasn't numbers that were going to win the war only, it was going to be equipment and the quality of the troops, you see. Anyway, it was with the greatest confidence and, in fact, it was a sense, to me, it was a sense of relief to get away from the office because I hated being tied to a desk.
What sort of preparation had you had, Mr. Lane, for when you went overseas? Did you have a lot of training?
As soon as we were mobilised, we were sent to Harford and were then sent back to Waltham Cross, where we alighted from the train, and then marched to Waltham Abbey to the Royal Gunpowder Factory. And we were there to relieve the 1st Battalion, the Rifle Brigade. And I can remember the 1st Battalion, the Rifle Brigade, marching past, going past us, because actually 12 of us were told to wait on Waltham Cross Station because we got to escort an ammunition wagon, which was, of course, horse-drawn, you see. And I can remember marching towards Waltham Abbey. One of us, each side of this ammunition wagon, it contained small arms ammunition, and the Rifle Brigade marching past us, you know. And we got fixed bayonets, which caused, I think, great amusement to the Rifle Brigade. And anyway, we eventually took up duty at the Royal Gunpowder Factory at Waltham Abbey, and we were on sentry at night, not in the daytime, I think, no, at night time, and our duty was to guard the power stations, I suppose you'd call them, where the actual power for working the machinery, you see. And they were spread all round. Waltham Abbey is in a low-lying area, and there are quite a few streams, small streams and that sort of thing, and that's why the factory was put there, probably. Anyway, we stayed there for about a month, I suppose, and it was a glorious summer weather, and we thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. We used to do night duty, sentry duty every night, and sleep for a bit during the day. And I can remember we were paid then our £5, what the troops call blood money. When you're mobilised, you got a bounty of £5, and it was all paid in the old-fashioned, I don't know if you've seen them, the old-fashioned £5 notes. They were beautiful, all done in beautiful calligraphy, you know. And most of our people, practically all of us, I'd seen £5 notes. I've been paid in £5 notes, but most of them, 99%, had never seen a £5 note. And what they wanted to do was to change it, you see, so they could start gambling. That was the main objective, with quite a lot of them. And so all these gambling schools were set up, and they couldn't all change their £5 notes, not at the rate of 5 golden sovereigns. Well, you couldn't get golden sovereigns anyway then. But they accepted £4.10 for them. And gambling schools were going on at Waltham Abbey all around the gunpowder building site for several days. Anyway, eventually we told we were going to leave Waltham Abbey, and we went to a place called Ruffham, about Rudghsam, about 5 miles from, or perhaps a bit less, from Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. And we were billeted in barns on a farm, a big farm there. And the weather continued to be absolutely marvellous. And we did our training there. Well, our training, I should say, to say the least, was rather sketchy. Anyway, really, we thoroughly enjoyed that. I think that's one of the happiest times of my life. We felt so fit, you see, because we were doing route marches, you see. We're doing and exercises and that sort of thing. And as well as ordinary drill and field exercises. And we had the most naive conception of what war was like, because when we were crossing a ploughed field and then we were supposed to be under attack, we lay down and put these heaps of turf in front of turned up soil, you know, they've come up in great lumps, thinking that that would protect us from rifle fire. Of course it wouldn't. And it really seemed quite a sort of pleasure, really. And we kept at Ruffham until the end of October. Then the weather closed in and it was getting sort of autumnal, you know, and there was one thing there that I would like to say about our training, and I've already said it in my document, that we never trained in carrying on without sleep. I can only remember one night exercise during the whole time, and that was still a couple of months or more. So that we didn't get used to going without sleep. We had our 8 hours pretty well every night, you see. Anyway, we went to Bury St Edmunds itself and were billeted in private houses. And we were expecting to stay there through the winter, really, I suppose. But anyway, after about a week, we were told that we were going overseas. I should perhaps explain that a territorial in those days, one of the conditions of service was that he was only to serve in England, you see. And before he went abroad, he had to volunteer. So we were all volunteers. Well, 95% of our battalion volunteered. And we were brought up to strength by new recruits. And then we were told, as I said, that we were going to sail. We were going abroad. We weren't told where we were going. We were issued with new rifles. Our old rifle was the long Lee Enfield, but we were issued with the new short Lee Enfield, and it was quite new, really. It was a new thing, and it was one of the best things we had. Well, to cut a long story short, we went to Southampton, and we landed at Le Havre. And we knew then that we were going to be on the Western Front, you see. We marched up to the camp at Le Havre. It was a dreadful foggy day, and the fog continued all night as well. The next morning, one of the first macabre incidents was that a man in the next tent to the one that I was in committed suicide. Well, he did. It's funny now, but poor devil, I suppose he must have had some sort of domestic trouble. We never knew what the answer was. We were told to keep away. Anyway, he blew his brains out and they all spattered all over the tent. Nothing bothered us very much in those days, and we went by train to Saint-Omer. Now, that was the headquarters of the British Army. General French was the commander-in-chief, of course. And we went to a village near Saint-Omer. And while we were there, we took part in an exercise in front of General French, and he referred, he was quite satisfied. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that in his book, 1914, that's the title of the book, he referred to us as a very fine battalion. Anyway, from there we went one day we were ordered to be prepared to move towards the front. And we marched to a certain position on the roadside, and there were lined up about 30 or 40 London omnibuses. And we boarded these omnibuses, and everybody wanted to get on the top of the bus because it was quite a nice day at that time. You know, it's fairly bright for November. But of course, we hadn't been going very long before it started to pour with rain. So we got thoroughly soaked, but that was just nothing to, that was unimportant. And we must have travelled for quite a few hours, and it was dark when we eventually reached our destination. And we were told to alight. Well, we alighted at this place, which incidentally was Vlamertinge. You know about that, I suppose, do you, Vlamertinge, don't you? Oh, it's Vlamertinge, I think. It's a well-known place in the 1914 war. We landed there. And it was still overcast, but the rain had stopped. And we were lined up and given a very generous issue of rum. Now, of course, most of us, quite a few of our men, of course, were used to beer. I wasn't. I never drank any beer. But this was a very potent spirit. And in no time, we were quite euphoric, really. We were quite happy. And then we marched off along a certain road. We didn't know where we were going, of course. And soon after we started, the moon broke through the clouds, and it was a lovely moonlight night. And I can remember on the as we marched along, we'd been going about quarter of an hour, I suppose. Shall I go on? And we passed a Roman Catholic priest. And as we passed, he removed his hat and murmured his blessings. I'd always remember that. And then we came to a town, which was, I suppose, Vlamertinge. And we had hardly, this was a sort of, the buildings were intact. They looked quite ancient, but they were quite intact. And suddenly there was the sound of a gunman firing, and the shell, a shrapnel shell came over and burst just at the head of the battalion. Well, it didn't hurt anybody. It simply fell onto the roof, the roofs of these houses, and sort of smashed the tiles, which clattered down into the road, you see. And then immediately after that, a number of what we thought were French soldiers came running towards us, and we thought that they were running away. We were very naive, because we were quite a long way from the trenches, really. Anyway, we carried on marching, and the enemy carried on shelling for a bit, but nobody was hit in our particular platoon. But I believe that further down behind the centre of the battalion, there were several casualties. Anyway, the Germans stopped firing, and we continued marching. And I remember saying to one of my friends, well, we can say we've been under fire anyway. And I can remember our captain, Captain Snowden, saying, "You haven't been under fire." And we carried on marching, and we eventually came to an open sort of field place. And we were told there's some trenches there, and you've got to spend the night there. Well, now, I'd already gone two or three nights, because I'd been on what they call transport duty, you see, for one night. And you simply lay out in the open. You had 2 hours on and 4 hours off. I had practically no sleep for 48 hours then. And I could not sleep in this... none of us could sleep sitting on a pack in a trench in November. We weren't used to it, you see. And of course, the effects of the rum issue were then wearing off, so we didn't feel quite so happy. In the morning, we were told to go up a hillside where we would find dugouts. And it was a wooded hillside. And we found dugouts, and we could rest there much more comfortably. You see, in a dugout, you could lay down, you see. And we stayed there that day. But during the morning, we didn't go to sleep in the morning. We simply came out to survey our surroundings, you see. And we saw a group of French soldiers. There was a road. From our hillside, we could see this road, quite a sort of a useful road, running, I suppose, into Ypres. And while we were watching, there was the sound of heavy gunfire. And after a few seconds, I suppose, there were three violent explosions right on this road. Just before that, we'd seen a group of French soldiers going along this road, and when the smoke had cleared, we saw that one of them, the group picking up one of the group, and immediately start to dig a grave for him. So those shells had killed him, you see. And we realized then what a, that was the first time we realized what the war was about, what the Germans could do, you see, because we didn't know. And well, then after that we went back to well, it stayed around this area. And the next day we were told the Germans had broken through and we were to go up to act as a reserve, you see. And we marched along a railway track, you know, from sleeper to sleeper sort of thing. And we passed a group of French cavalrymen, and they had they must have been dragoons, I think. I thought they were cuirassiers, but they must have been dragoons. They had these helmets with the horsehair tail on. We got to an open field between two woods, really, and we were told to dig a trench. Well, we dug this trench. The idea was that we were to act as a sort of long stop to try and stop the Germans getting through. Of course, up to that time, they'd been really terrific battles going on there. And anyway, the attack was beaten off before they got to us, so that was all right. And we came back to our position.